Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
Let's be real. Think search and social are the only options in advertising? We've got news for you. Nucleus is the new national platform reaching 147 million uniques and delivering more than 155 million video and ad impressions each month, all in the brand-safe news environments you can trust. Visit us at nucleusmarketing.com to learn more.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast. My name is Zach Rogers. I'm the executive editor of Ad Exchanger, and I'm very pleased to have Eric Eichmann, the CEO of Criteo, in the studio today. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Gosh, this is exciting. Criteo is one of the great high-flying advertising technology companies, valued today $3 billion. In the early days of retargeting, Criteo distinguished itself with pretty unparalleled publisher development, operation, and engineering capabilities. Mm-hmm. Continues to grow like a weed. 32% growth, excluding traffic acquisition costs last quarter. Great to have you in the studio.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So let's start with that growth. Criteo has been defying gravity on revenue for a few years. How long can you keep that up?
Well, so defining gravity, I'm not sure. We serve a very useful purpose, and sort of the inception of the company and what we do is really convert data that's very sort of that's left by users on e-commerce sites into sales. And that's the magic. That's the value proposition. It's a performance-based model. And as long as you have sort of opportunities to do that better, and the growth of e-commerce continues, that's going to be a bigger and bigger pie.
And you did it better because of your early at work around publisher development and also—
Publisher development is one of the aspects. Mm-hmm. I think there's a number of aspects. A lot of them are technology-based.
Right.
And so we can talk a little bit more about that. But maybe just to illustrate that, just giving some clarity around the quarter and when the growth is coming from might be helpful to understand where sort of where the growth comes from and where it has. So if you look at the, I think it's about 34% net revenue, so revenue ex-TAC, ex-traffic acquisition costs, year on year on the quarter to $220 million. And that growth has been driven by two things on the core retargeting business. We also have a new business, the HookLogic acquisition, created the Criteo sponsored products, and that's also a business that's part of our numbers today.
Right.
But focusing on the sort of the core dynamic retargeting, there's been two drivers, two big drivers. One is the growth of existing client spend. So think of in retail would be same store sales growth. And that this quarter in Q2, year on year, was 17%. And this is a number that has grown since I've been at Criteo now 4.5 years, every quarter. And so clients that were with us last year and continue to be with us this year, which is the majority of the clients, are spending 17% more than they spent last year. That comes from a number of sources. One is technology. And we give examples of technology improvements that we make. For example, this last quarter, we put into place a new engine that used 10 new variables, and that gave us a 5% uplift over what we did. This is just basically doing the optimization better.
Right.
Targeting customers better, doing better product recommendations, better creative optimization, et cetera. And that's one of the aspects. And the second one, as you rightly pointed out, we've been always front and center in terms of developing technologies and accessing inventory on the publisher side. A couple of things to mention there. The Criteo Direct Bidder, I'm sure we'll talk a bit about that later on, is something that we now deploy to 450 publishers. And for those publishers, we're seeing a yield improvement. So the spend that we do with them is increasing by 20 to 40%.
Mm-hmm.
So that's positive because that generally means that when we spend more with publishers, we make more money for our advertisers. And the other thing on the publisher side that's driving these existing sort of client sales growth is also native in general. It's actually 25% of our total sort of spend today is native. So that's one big area, the existing client growth. And the second one is we keep on adding clients to our network. We now have over 18,000. In the last quarter, we added 950 net new clients. So that's the growth on the retargeting side, and obviously with Criteo sponsored products, it's still an early stage product for us. We're mostly in the U.S. We're also expanding.
This is the former HookLogic.
This is the former HookLogic. Right. So it's Criteo sponsored products were brands sort of buy placements on a performance basis on retailer sites to drive sales of their products.
Mm-hmm.
And that's growing very well. That's also obviously growing well for us. And it's one where we're developing not just the business, but integrating the technologies as part of the effort we're making this year.
Yeah, so HookLogic works with to help publishers make money. Whereas you often receive payments from publishers. So you're bringing in that sell side business in under your roof is one way to look at it.
So it's interesting because the retailers we work with are e-commerce companies.
Right.
When they do retargeting with us, they're obviously paying us money to drive sales on their sites.
Right.
And when we sort of approach them from a Criteo sponsored product side, they're a publisher.
Mm-hmm.
They're now sort of opening up placements on their sites for us to place ads from brands. Now, there's lots of similarities because the brands are placing those ads on a CPC performance basis.
Right.
And we're driving, our intent is always to drive a conversion for those products that they're looking to sponsor. So
there's like a huge cross-sell opportunity for you there with all of these retailers that have been your customers for so long. You can try to integrate that HookLogic solution. I'm sorry, not HookLogic, but
Criteo sponsored products.
You can try to integrate the Criteo sponsored product solution across these thousands and thousands.
Yeah, so there were probably three main reasons for the acquisition.
Uh-huh.
And then obviously there's many things that made us feel comfortable that the companies thought the same way. We're performance-based, we're CPC.
Mm-hmm.
But the first reason was that we have a very extensive network of retailers across the globe. And that is about 15,000 of them across the globe of the 18,000 customers that we have. And HookLogic had about 250 retailers in their network. So that's an opportunity to expand. The second part of it is we've been focusing for, a good 9 years since the company was founded on optimization, on driving sales and optimizing the performance. And we can bring that technology plus we're a much larger company than HookLogic when it was acquired. And so we've gone through all the pain of scaling the business, creating all the infrastructure. And so there's a whole technology side to it that we're integrating now as part of a big effort we're doing. And then the third thing is it opens up a big, big opportunity with brands. So we were working with brands that were retailers in the past, but we were not working with brands that are pushing product through third-party retailers. And so brands, obviously, brand manufacturers, right? Because many things are brands, but brand manufacturers are some of the largest spenders in advertising in the world. Take, consumer packaged good companies, for example. And so that opens up this client set to bring to them new advertising opportunities. So those were the three big reasons.
Not merely lower in the funnel, but
Not necessarily, right? So we'll talk a little bit about sort of what we're building and what we have. But so we think there's opportunity in the funnel, which is what happens in the lower parts of the funnel, which is what happens on retailer sites where there's intent to buy certain things. And we use that intent information to drive the products that the brands are looking to sponsor.
So there's a prospecting opportunity.
But there's
let's come back to that because I'd like to stay focused on your performance and what's driving it. And you talk about targeting, you talk about better creative, you talk about native, you talk about integration of the publisher side acquisition that you did recently. But to me, it all boils down to engineering prowess and operational excellence.
Yeah.
I'm curious, how did a company based in France, nothing against like French business, I mean, there are a lot of great French companies, but they're not known for being sort of technology companies historically as much as like United States based companies in Silicon Valley in particular. How did this company build this culture around technology development, and how has it maintained such a high standard?
So I think, that's a great question. It's a question we often get also from investors because there's not a full understanding of necessarily European companies and they were going. First, I should say we're a global company now.
Mm-hmm.
We have over 2,700 employees, of which about 800, 900 are in France. So we are global now. And France as a country from a revenue perspective is a small part of our revenue base. It's important. It's one of our top five countries, but it's in the 5% range. So it's not as significant. So we really are a global company. And from an R&D perspective, even though It is true that our core sort of site is Paris. We also have a Palo Alto office and an Arbor office. So we have a global team of R&D. Now you asked the question, how were we successful? In particular, since we saw competition and pretty strong one from actors like Google and others that basically thought that was their sort of expertise and, mm-hmm. and they should be able to win that war. I think what made a difference from the beginning, the company never started thinking about advertising. The company always started thinking about how can we use the data that users leave on sites to drive sales. And so it started as a product recommendation engine to go to retailers to place ads, just like Amazon was doing, on their site to drive sales. Mm-hmm. And then that was a hard business model, you know, it involved changing people's sites, leaving on their site and all of that. And so at some point, the founders tried advertising. They didn't know anything about advertising. They actually did a Google search for what an ad server was. And they built it from that. And advertising, well, behold, of course, it worked. And it started driving sort of revenues at an ROI that was similar to search. As a matter of fact, our first sort of tagline was expand your search. Because mm-hmm. many e-commerce companies were doing search, were very happy with it, but they couldn't sort of do more search at the same ROI. And so we came in and we say, we can do the same for
helped
you.
Helped extend those budgets and that kind of, exactly. that marketing mindset.
Yeah. And so that was started. I think what makes a big difference in our company is that since the beginning, we're always about using data to drive sales. And everything that we do in the company, the 2,700 people that work in the company are always thinking, it's very clear, the metric of success is, are we driving more sales for the advertisers or the e-commerce companies that we're working with? And so we do constantly A-B tests, both on the publisher side, on the engine side. And from a pure engineering perspective, I mean, France produces extremely good engineers. We're a magnet for European talent. And when we started, I mean, this is all machine learning, artificial intelligence based. And the bigger the data set that you have, the faster you can innovate on the algorithm that you build. You know, machine learning algorithms are not sort of static things. They evolve over time. They become better. It's kind of pruning a tree to get it to a place. And the faster we improved the algorithm, the more clients we could get in. The more clients would get in, the more data we would have, the faster we could improve. And that is similar dynamics that sort of, I guess, Google saw in search. And it got to the point where we were far ahead and sort of the scale, the network effects that we got both on the publisher side and on the advertiser side made it very hard to catch up with us. I mean, we work with the largest e-commerce companies in the world and we get all the data from them to be able to deliver performance to them. You know, we do have a very sort of diverse engineering talent and we look for talent in Palo Alto. We have, as I said, a great office in Ann Arbor. But in Europe, we don't only attract the talent from France and we're what's great is we can attract the best talent. And France is well known for sort of producing engineers that are very good at sort of mathematical problems and things that lead themselves very much to machine learning algorithms. And so, but we attract a lot of talent from Eastern Europe and from many places in Europe. And I think once we've grown to a certain scale, it was very hard to catch up. I would say the other thing, we're very early in developing our publisher business. So when the company started, we realized that to be able to do the things that we do for advertisers, for e-commerce companies, we need to be buying users. And at the time, you had a very traditional sort of ad environment where you had to buy audiences and you had to make commitments up front. And so we went to publishers and we said, no, we're not interested in audiences. We're interested in users. Mm-hmm. And for that, we need to have a real-time programmatic way of accessing your data and sort of bidding on your users. And so a lot of the tools that we develop, and that's why we have a history in publisher, because programmatic didn't exist in 2008, 2009, the way that we have it today. And mm-hmm. so we had to go to publishers and develop mechanisms to buy those. And we developed sort of technologies. Some of them, like you would hear that a lot of them are sort of similar technologies that are used now for header bidding.
Well, in our early coverage of header bidding, a lot of people said, Criteo developed header bidding essentially like long ago. And so, in a way, you were ahead of the market with that.
Yes, and we were not thinking that we never thought of this as a mechanism to sort of make to get advertisers and publishers to work together or to create an exchange. We were always thinking in terms of sort of getting access to inventory in a way that would drive sales for our advertisers. So I think that's one of the things that distinguishes us from other companies is we're very much focused on how can we drive sales. Mm-hmm. And so we're not in the market to make advertising at large better. We're really in the market to use data. Through, mm-hmm. Yes, it happens through advertising, but to use data to drive sales.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let's talk about the retail environment, because it's hard to escape a certain sense of gloom that pervades every retailer who is not Amazon right now. Most of them are shrinking, some of them dramatically. Yes. Some of them are closing dozens of stores. Some of them are closing hundreds of stores.
Yeah.
You know, these are your customers. Mm-hmm. Amazon, as everyone knows, is hugely ambitious.
Yeah.
And their most recent acquisition of Whole Foods shows that they understand offline commerce is going to continue to be a big part of how people shop.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, you know, with all of this retail fallout already underway, what impact do you expect on your customers and on their advertising budgets, including retargeting?
Yeah. So maybe just to take a bit of a step back, I do think that Amazon is very disruptive and they're doing a lot of things right. And so I think they're a great model for a number of things. Having said that, I think people forget that, I was looking at different statistics and one sort of anywhere between 85 to 90% of commerce happens offline. So that's more than, by my calculation, more than 5-6 times what online is, right? And so the majority of commerce is still offline. And so this idea that retailers are just going to disappear tomorrow, I think is not right. What's happening, and this is true, is that retail stores, I think we probably have too many retail stores for the demand that there is. I mean, I think malls were built at twice the rate of population growth in the U.S. since the 50s. And so we're a bit too over-invested there.
Right.
Having said that, those sales are not going to go away. And what I see as a big opportunity is if you take, say, a Saks Fifth Avenue, which has a decent presence online, but their presence offline obviously trumps anything that they have online. And so the opportunity is really to use, instead of the current storyline, oh, the stores are a huge liability, right? I mean, yes, because you have to make money in them. You have lots of sort of fixed costs that go with it, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of thinking of it as a liability, think of it as an asset. You have incredible data on users. Why not sort of use that to drive your online business and to create omnichannel strategies that basically make you more powerful? And by the way, I think Amazon buying Whole Foods is a confirmation that Amazon realizes that to be bigger and bigger in commerce, they need an offline presence.
Right.
And there's lots of technology that can be brought to bear to the offline environment to actually drive the business in a much healthier way. And so we think there's a big opportunity for retailers to be able to do this. And as a matter of fact, you know, in this sort of, we'll get to this a little bit later, but for us, sort of the use of data and the technology that you need to activate that data to make sense are two of the things that we can bring to retailers. We'll talk about the commerce marketing ecosystem, which we've announced recently. But to your specific question on retargeting budgets, there's a couple of things. One is when times get tough, in general, what sort of marketers and commerce companies do is they focus their marketing on things that work or where they have a clear sort of relationship between the spend and the sales that they drive. And that's what we have. We have, you know, we've had now for 25 quarters, 90% retention. And that's because there's a very clear relationship between the two. And then the second thing is, obviously, all of our retargeting business today is online, you know. Over time, maybe we'll have an offline to online portion of it. But those businesses are growing. So online is growing. Even for these large companies, these retailers that we talk about are struggling, their business around online commerce is growing, maybe not as fast as Amazon's, but it is growing.
Right.
So, you know, Or retargeting business continues to do very well, and we continue to increase the spend on a per client basis every year. So,
right.
So that should give you. So we don't see a slowdown. As a matter of fact, we just see a faster transformation to technology and use of data and online. A focus on driving people online and using omnichannel.
Okay,
and that's very positive for us. Amazon has created a bit of a wake up call for a lot of these retailers to understand that it's not a nice to have a growing and thriving sort of online business. It's actually a must have now to basically combine the offline and the online and make a broader business out of it.
Right, right. And we've seen a great deal of aggressiveness from Walmart making many acquisitions, including Bonobos and you know, we'll talk about Walmart more in a moment, but I want to stay
acquisition,
on
Jet. Yes,
I want and Jet, the big one where they got Mark Laurie, and he's now sort of spearheading their e-commerce and digital growth strategy. Fascinating story there. But let's stay on Criteo for just another moment because you know you mentioned the commerce marketing ecosystem as you know an opportunity for you to you know further enable the retailer to embrace data in their operations. Talk about what that is. And then part two, what else could you do in the future to enable, to become the commerce infrastructure for some of these companies that really do need help?
Right. So maybe just we've defined our vision for the company to be to build the highest performing and open commerce marketing ecosystem that helps shoppers find the things they need and love. And so what that is really helping retailers and brands drive performance at scale from their data and from a number of opportunities that we put forward. I think to think about what the sort of the themes that are playing out that are becoming very important, that are becoming sort of like the new areas of competition, in particular in this world where Amazon is making big moves and is sort of disrupting the market, is one, it's very clear the data is a critical part of any strategy of any retailer now. You and I as consumers leave a trail of information. It doesn't have to be identify with us. It's not Zach's information. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, a cookie ID or whatever the ID we want. But you're leaving all this information. You as a consumer want that information to be used in a way that sort of delivers relevant experiences to you. I think we're past that point where consumers want relevant sort of information or relevant sort of interactions with brands. So data is critical. The second thing that's becoming critical when you talk
tell
about
it to
data,
Apple. Oh, sorry, we'll come back to that.
We'll come back to that.
There's a lot to come back to.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Yeah,
it's going to be a long episode, people. Settle in. No, it's all good.
The second thing is scale. So having your own data, if you're a $100 million sort of online e-commerce site, is not enough. You're missing a whole bunch of things. You can't connect people across devices. You can't infer information about the person in total. And so scale is very, very important. And the third thing is you can have all the data you want. If you don't know how to activate it on a real-time basis, you can't do much with it. And so this is something that Amazon does very well, is they sort of throughout their ecosystem, once you're sucked in as a consumer into their ecosystem, they keep you. They use other mechanisms. Obviously, Amazon is convenience. They have great selection. They have Prime. But they have all kinds of marketing mechanisms to keep you in there. And this is one of the things. So when you think about that, and we think about the sort of privileged position that we've been able to build over time, not thinking about creating a commerce marketing ecosystem initially, but you know, we see $550 billion in sales with our partners. So the 18,000 sort of folks that we work with have $550 billion in sales. That's almost twice as much as what Amazon sees. And we see all the intent information that comes before it. And so that's data at scale. And it's intent data. The best intent data you can have is sort of all the information, all the trail that consumers leave on e-commerce sites. And obviously, we've built technology that activates that data on a real-time basis. So we built the publisher technology, but we've obviously built the optimization technology for that sort of to work very well. So, you know, one important aspect of this is that retailers, e-commerce companies, in joining this commerce marketing ecosystem have to understand that there's a concept of collaboration that becomes very important. So when you have a $100 million business and you're competing with a company that has or sees $300 billion and is a technology company, you're happy to contribute that as long as you get something bigger in return.
Okay, so, So PetSmart has a lot of information about their customer, not only what they're in market for, but also where they're connecting to PetSmart, so you can identify them across devices. Right. They share that into your co-op, which is called Commerce Marketing Ecosystem, and then they get access to all of the data that's been shared into the same co-op by all of your other customers. So, is that right?
So I think the idea is that we're going to have an ecosystem that's open, that's transparent. So when open means everybody can participate. Transparent means that the exchange of value is very clear. The use of data is very clear. When you sign up to share data, you know what the data is being used on. I would say it's going to be it is a lot more transparent, and I'll give you a couple of examples than what you do when you work with some of the sort of the large walled gardens where you provide a lot of data and you're not always clear on how that is being used. But let me give you the example of CRM data. So we've been going out now for 2.5-3 years to all of our partners. We said, provide us your CRM data. It's hashed emails generally with sort of so that we can create a device graph. The device graph will help your retargeting because we'll be able to identify users across different devices and multiple environments even within the same device. And in exchange for that, you also get access to it. So today, you know, people contribute to this device graph. We have now 3/4 of our sort of clients contributing to it. We also sort of put other information into the device graph to amplify it, to make it better. And we're getting just as an indication of...
Does that include intent data or is it strictly device data?
This is device data. So this is
there's no intent data at all.
Yeah. So this is a pooled asset that we sort of have gotten together from everybody collaborating, and the benefits of it now are distributed to everybody. So they can get access to it so that they can do personalization on their site across devices, across multiple environments.
Yeah, it improves match rates, it improves reach,
But we allow also people to do, for example, CRM onboarding. So now based on that, we're getting match rates of hashed emails to online identities that are, as we've heard from the partners that we're testing this with, are as good as Google and Facebook's.
Got it.
Better than Google and Facebook in certain geographies. So in Europe, for example, it is better. And so that gives you a sense for, so here's little tiny Criteo, right?
Right.
So not that tiny, but in the context of these global sort of internet companies, we're quite small, and we're able to produce an asset that has similar performance levels than what Facebook or Google have. And so that's the power of collaboration now. So there's a couple of other, we think, big assets that are important. One is this shopper product intent graph that covers across. So today, the permission that we have is we can get your info, PetSmart, and we'll use that for your own purposes. We don't use that information for other things, right? Mm-hmm. So we won't use that information to help Walmart or Best Buy or Target sort of do retargeting. So there's Chinese walls, if you will, around the data that is used for those users. What things that we would come out with is we would say, okay, you can participate in this pooled asset where we're going to sort of unify all the data. And that data will be used to drive traffic to your site from advertising that would come from brands, for example. Or it can be used to help you do prospecting. And they would have to agree to that.
Okay.
A big part of that asset working is that is creating what we would call a universal catalog, which allows to identify product attributes across retailers. So that when you're looking at a red skirt on Target, let's say, that you can identify that as not just a product ID with an image, but as a product that has red skirt as attributes, apparel, et cetera. And you can identify that in other sites. So that's a big part of sort of the technology investment we're making now is just how can we build a universal catalog that helps sort of make sense of that data. That's the second big pooled asset. The third one is what we call a measurement network. This is getting permission from the retailers to see the sales information. We see it today, but it's getting the permission to share that with third parties. So in the case of what we're talking about, Criteo-sponsored products, XHookLogic product, we have that permission from retailers to be able to share that information with brands. And so that's the reason why brands obviously spend money on advertising. But when you think about those pooled assets, there's a number of products that we can bring that sort of use, again, data at scale and technology that we bring to bear to help these companies compete against these large e-commerce platforms.
Once you become a central resource for thousands upon thousands of companies, is there more you can do? Fast forward 3-5 years.
Yeah.
Could Criteo get into logistics, fulfillment? Are there things that you want to do to become more of a holistic commerce enabler?
So we thought about some of these things.
Okay.
We think the core capability that we bring to bear, obviously, is technology. That's our DNA. We're great about taking data and converting that into sales. And so that's where we start. I would never say never, but at the same time, I think logistics and these types of things are far away from our area of expertise and whether the same sort of dynamics around scale and network effects exist in those businesses, probably not. At least I don't see it today.
Okay.
So I would say no, but things like, for example, web to store sort of retargeting uses the device graph to convert offline identities from the store visitors to online identities, and we use the data that people leave, the purchases that they do offline, to drive online customers. That's a product that we're bringing to market already. We're testing with customers that allows, say, a Saks Fifth Avenue to use the power of their offline presence to drive online visitors, which is where they one of the areas they need to grow. That also provides us the ability over time to potentially do the inverse, create the bridge between the online and the offline world and see how online advertising is affecting their offline sales. So there's a number of products that will leverage these assets that will make them a lot more competitive against these e-commerce platforms.
But we shouldn't look for a Criteo FedEx merger. Okay, got it.
No.
silly question, I know, but I just had to ask. But I do want to go back for a second to the data sharing stuff that you can enable between customers because and talk about it in the context of the global privacy regime that's emerging.
Yes.
Obviously, privacy means different things to different people.
Yeah.
It means one thing in the United States. It means something else in Europe. In Europe, no surprise, it's shaping up to be a much sort of tougher nut to crack for technology companies.
Always been,
And also, but in the U.S., we have areas where it's getting tougher as well. And in fact, on your earnings call, you mentioned some uncertainties around Apple's intelligent tracking prevention, which essentially blocks third-party tags like yours from tracking users in Safari. So what we're finding is with the policies in Europe and the Apple's new policy, surprise, surprise, the duopoly looks pretty strong, you know, and just in turn from a data sharing and data activation point of view, that first party relationship with the consumer is favored by law and by company policies, whereas the third party relationship, which is the sharing or partner type relationship, is disadvantaged. What will be the impact of this kind of emerging situation? And obviously, it's a long game. It could change again.
So let me separate the two issues because you've talked about ITP from Apple, which is one issue, and then regulations coming from governments or sort of entities sort of related to the government. In Europe in particular, there's this GDPR regulation that is coming into effect.
Yes.
And, you know, we see it as a positive development for a couple of reasons. If you look, the details have not all been worked out, but there are two sort of big themes that emerge. One is a theme around user consent. And one of the things that the European Union, which if you travel to Europe, you'll know this, that when you go into sites, you always ask by first time you go into a site whether it's okay for the site to use cookies to improve the experience. And so, you know, they think the realization is that was a bit of a clunky way of asking for sort of consent. And so some of the things that sort of are being talked about is, can we have a universal consent for users that are more browser level or something like that? And then the second thing is whether you have a legitimate reason to sort of actually collect the data.
Right.
On both fronts, actually, I think we see it quite well. We ask for user consent specifically for users for data tracking. We've done it on Safari browsers. We've done it since Safari browsers didn't allow third-party cookies to or third parties to track cookies, and we've gotten consent by doing this on the advertiser site. And we initially did it in Europe. It wasn't a problem to implement because they were already used to asking consumers. In the US, it was a slower sort of implementation because it wasn't required by law. But we have always abided by three principles. Is one, sort of like control from the users, which is two, transparency about what we're doing with the data. And the third one is non-PII, so no personal identifiable information. And so based on those principles, we, you know, it's not that we're not aware of the changes and we're very involved in what's going to happen and how it's going to impact us, but we feel quite comfortable about our position. ITP is a little bit different, obviously. You know, Apple's intent there is to give control to consumers and to exclude what Apple considers to be, based on sort of their own view of the world, to be sort of experiences that they don't think consumers like. So in those experiences are things like retargeting and sort of ads based on data.
Apple really likes generic, irrelevant advertising.
Yes, correct. So here's a couple of things to think about. One is it's not clear what Apple is going to do. So by the sort of broad statement that they made, there's a number of things that are going to break in the user experience. Take your subscription to the Wall Street Journal goes through a third party to be authenticated before you go. Well, that would break. Unless mm-hmm. you go sort of every day, but that would break. And so over the weekend, every Monday, you would have to re-enter all your information. Not good. People are not going to adapt.
Right.
And so, you know, one, it's not clear how it's going to happen. From our perspective, there's other mechanisms to keep the information. So you can do it at the publisher side. You can use other parts of the browser to track the information. And so it's a bit of a, you know, kind of mouse game in terms of how you can do it. We think the idea, and so this is sort of where we see completely eye to eye with Apple, the idea to give consumers control is a very good thing. Consumers, I think, in general understand or agree with the concept of free stuff in exchange for advertising. And mm-hmm. for the advertising to work, you need to use data these days. Mm-hmm. And so if you gave a consumer a choice of you pay for content or you don't pay for it and get free stuff, mm-hmm. they'll choose 99.999% of the time
right.
the free stuff with advertising. So that concept is not well understood. By the way, I think Apple understands that in the app environment, mm-hmm. that's the case. The app environment is not being affected by this change. They use IDFA, which we use, to basically have advertising. So we would suggest that if the intent is that Apple take a broader view and use an IDFA-type mechanism that covers the mobile browser, where really this is going to be affecting because Safari is not doesn't have a big share on the desktop, and allow the consumers to choose whether they want IDFA to be turned on or not. And I think that would sort of create a real choice for consumers and would treat all environments the same. Mm-hmm. But having said that, for Apple, it's still early to know what exactly is going to be put in place.
Right.
It's still also early to know what companies that have large exchanges, in particular Google, mm-hmm. are going to do. But obviously, they see the information, right? They see consumers coming to their site every day mm-hmm. Or to their myriads of sites. Mm-hmm. And so they have a solution that it can probably apply to themselves, but they also have businesses where they sort of facilitate advertising on the web. And mm-hmm. so, you know, that's still one of the big questions is how is a company like Google and in particular products like AdX going to react to this change.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So, Eric, we're running a little short on time.
Okay.
So what I want to
yes.
do is move to a sort of a rapid-fire question format.
All right.
I will try to ask these questions in a way that you can answer them shortly and do your best to keep your answer under
okay.
10
we'll
or
do.
10 seconds or 20 seconds.
Okay.
Let's start with last click, something that's, of course, not conducive to a short answer. But you guys still benefit from last click attribution. Obviously, the future is multi-touch, omni-channel.
Yeah.
How many years before last click goes away? I'm trying to ask it in a format you can answer briefly.
So I would say attribution discussions will go on forever. So last click is probably not the right one.
Right.
I do think a click from an ad is a clear indication of engagement because people don't click on ads that often. So that will a click will always be a an important part of engaging a consumer in something they didn't intend to do at that point in time. So clicks will always be part of it, whether last or first or middle, I don't know.
Got it. Header bidding, adoption among publishers is very high
yes.
right now. What's been the impact for you on pricing, ad pricing?
It's been positive. I think what happened initially, because there were a lot of second price auctions, prices went up. Then they stabilized because people sort of adapted to the new. And then we developed Criteo direct bidding technologies that we've been implementing with publishers. And we're now seeing yields of 20 to 40% higher for those publishers. So very positive.
And the auction, the programmatic yeah. impression auction, is moving to first price away yeah. from second price. How does that change your bidding strategy, or does it?
So I would say, first of all, our opinion is that what's most important is transparency about the auction dynamics. If you read about sort of best auctions to extract the most value, most people will tell you second price auctions are better because they incent people to bid the actual value price as opposed to trying to play under it. First price auctions generally are just cleaner because they're transparent. You bid something, and if you get the impression, you paid what you bid for. And based on some of the things that happened with ad exchanges and SSPs, it seems like there were a lot of hidden fees. So if that's the only way to get transparency, first price auctions are great. Otherwise, I would say, you know, what we really care about is transparency about the auction. And first price versus others doesn't matter to us as long as transparency is there.
Okay, got it. You guys have added a lot of new capabilities around your core retargeting
yeah.
product. But there are things that a lot of marketers, basic things a lot of marketers
right.
don't do, like audience suppression. Suppress your own customers.
Yeah.
I mean, how many of your customers are doing that kind of thing today? It's more advanced techniques.
So very few. And we would encourage
Why
them not?
I mean, because it would improve the user experience and save them money.
Would it really? Not necessarily. So I think that's a broad statement that I don't agree with.
Okay,
so,
fine.
So I look, ultimately, we pay for the impressions that we serve, and we only get paid if we drive sales. So we have no interest in serving, and the engine has no interest in serving sort of lots of ads that don't work. So we make this available to customers. We try to dissuade them from it because rules-based systems that are determined by, if you will, marketing departments that determine this is the right way of doing it because of XYZ will never beat the machine that takes into account billions and billions of interactions from consumers and machine
okay.
learning. So our approach is technology will always do a better job if your intent is to maximize sales.
Got it. Final question. You heavily compete with Amazon. Amazon's best and biggest competitor is Walmart. Does it make sense for Walmart to acquire Criteo at some point to help it catch up in commerce and data?
Well, we just, you know, we don't compete directly with Amazon. We serve customers that
you compete with them for impressions.
We do. On the publisher side, we do compete, and they obviously have a similar view of people that they want to go
you
after.
You and Amazon are bidding each other up for a lot of
We're probably
space.
The largest sort of that are looking at users from a retargeting perspective. There's no question there. But I would say we help other companies compete with Amazon. We also work with some of the Amazon subsidiaries. So I to your question about Walmart, obviously I'm not Walmart. I can't answer that question from the Walmart perspective. But, you know, we're trying to create an ecosystem that's going to help all brands and all retailers sort of get the benefits of data at scale and technology to activate that data. And so, you know, if the question is always whether one player will get more benefit out of that, knowing that when you acquire a company, you might get some of your competitors sort of dropping out of the client list versus sort of participating in it. And that's, you know, I'll leave that question to better
Oh, wow.
minds.
Well, it's hard to leave it there, but we must leave it there. A really great discussion. Thanks so much for coming into the studio, Eric Eichmann.
Thank you very much, Zach.
And thank you, listener, for tuning in. We'll see you next week.
Produced by Bigfoot Music and Sound in New York City.